This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Where did we come from? It's a key question, one that has haunted man since the very beginning of time. Scientists in many fields have dedicated their lives and careers to answering that question, and we're probably closer today than we were 500 or even 50 years ago, but it seems that with every new discovery, more questions are raised. Recently, scientists in South Africa discovered the remains of a previously unknown species. Those remains covered the floor of a cave that could only be accessed through a very narrow crack in a limestone wall. This find introduces us to a new member of the pre-human family. Some say it is an evolutionary bombshell, one that may cause a paradigm shift in the way we think about human evolution. Certainly worth talking about, so that's how we'll spend this hour. We're joined by Dr. Zachary Throckmorton and Jonathan Marks. Dr. Throckmorton is Assistant Professor of Anatomy at Lincoln Memorial University's DeBusk College of Osteopathic Medicine in Harrogate, Tennessee. He is among a select international group of scientists invited to study specimens of this new species called Homo naledi. In fact, he co-authored the first published analysis of the species, and he joins us by phone with the flu. Good morning. Welcome to the program, and thank you for doing it.
Hey, thank you very much, and happy National Fossil Day.
Okay. Is it really National Fossil Day?
It sure is. Well, sponsored by the National Park Service.
How propitious. Well, thank you for being here. Dr. Marks is a professor of anthropology at UNC Charlotte and author of Tales of the X-Apes, How We Think About Human Evolution, and also What It Means to Be 98% Chimpanzee. He is with us in our studio. Welcome back.
Hi, Mike.
Oh, let me turn your mic on. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Hi, Mike.
Nice to have you here.
Pleasure to be here.
We're off to a great start, aren't we? We're going to talk a lot about human evolution here this morning, but there are those who still struggle with the concept of evolution, of any kind of animal evolution, so let's get it out of the way. Both of you are scientists from different disciplines and interested in evolution. Dr. Marks, you're both an anthropologist and a geneticist. Dr. Throckmorton, professor of anatomy. Are most scientists convinced that Darwin was right?
No, all scientists are convinced that Darwin was right.
And why are they certain of this?
Well, if the question is, did we evolve? Mm-hmm. Okay.
And are we evolving?
Sure. Then the question is, what do we mean by evolution? And let's talk about evolution as just being naturalistic change through time. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, everyone in the scientific community is satisfied with that. We're certainly tweaking the human gene pool in small ways now, but not in ways that are really obvious to see with the naked eye, so to speak.
But as a geneticist, you're seeing things genetically that are changing or that do change or that change by happenstance. And to you, that is evidence of evolution.
Well, that's microevolution in a small sense. Island populations that are genetically isolated from other islands have their own gene pools, which get tweaked in strange ways. Any group of people has their own unique microevolutionary history.
And the reason...
I'm sorry, go ahead, doctor. I'd start out by disagreeing with Dr. Marks.
Oh, my God.
You get two scientists in a room, you're going to have 20 opinions, but... I just point out that microevolution can sometimes make a lot of difference, as anybody who's sat down and had pizza or ice cream with somebody who's lactose intolerant can tell you about 15 to 20 minutes later. You might not be able to see the difference, but you can probably start smelling it.
Well, speaking as someone who is lactose intolerant, I can't disagree with that statement.
Would you say then that the reason so many people deny evolution is because we can't see it? We can't see it with the naked eye. We have to see it over stretches of time that are far longer than our existence on the planet.
My thinking is that people who reject evolution at this point, whatever evidence you bring to bear in it on it isn't going to convince them.
Okay,
they're sort of evidence impaired. The sad thing is that biblical literalism is not really a way to think about even the Bible, according to most theologians. You know, it's not particularly well known, but Pope Francis is an evolutionist. You know, most Catholics are evolutionists. Thomas Aquinas didn't take the Bible literally. St. Augustine didn't take the Bible literally. Most Jews don't take the Bible literally. Talmud is about how you interpret the Bible for every generation, and Catholic thought goes on a parallel track to that. So in a sense, biblical literalism is just a theological dispute within Protestantism, and it's something that scientists really ought to stay out of, as far as I'm concerned, because it's a theological dispute.
But evolution, is that why you call us in your book ex-apes? Is that why you call us that? Because we are descended from the apes, or we're part of that family tree?
Exactly. We're part of that family tree. We evolved from apes. And unfortunately, there is a tendency within the scientific community to say things that are sometimes a little bit outrageous to try and tweak the noses of creationists. And I think that's a problem. By saying, for example, that we are apes rather than our ancestors were apes.
So I was looking through this material yesterday, and there was this big tree drawn somewhere on one of these pieces of paper that I have stacked in front of me of the ape family tree, the Homo family tree.
Homo is human.
Okay.
And our ancestry is in that tree.
Okay.
Okay. So we evolved from apes. But I think it's a very strong statement to say, or it's a loaded statement to say we are apes today.
Okay.
Because largely by the same, our ancestors were apes. Our ancestors were also fish, much more distantly. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to say we're fish. There's a lot we can learn by grappling with our ancestry as fish, for example, that we gestate in an aqueous saline environment. That counts for something early in human life. But I wouldn't want to say that we are fish.
So as I was looking at this tree, there were chimpanzees on the tree. There were gorillas on the tree. Yep. And this is part of, I don't remember high school science very well, because I deliberately tried to expunge it from my mind. But help me fit in where we fit on the tree with this new discovery and where it fits on the tree. Maybe Dr. Throckmorton can chime in on that.
Sure. Well, humans, I always kind of chuckle when I see phylogenetic trees showing lines of descent and evolutionary relationships. I always wish there was one that had the apes up in the trees and us down on the ground, because that's one of the things that really defines us, is that we spend most of our time down on the ground now. And our position is still the same position that it was before Homo naledi was discovered, before Darwin came up with his insight into the way that organisms are related to each other. And naledi doesn't really change where we are or who we are, but we certainly have a much better picture of what the surroundings are near us, and we have much more information about a relative of ours that once lived on the planet and no longer does, that has gone extinct. And we know that it is going to, that this relative of ours is very close on the basis of its anatomy of its whole body. But we're not entirely certain where it fits in yet with some of the other extinct human relatives that we've known about for many years, such as the Neanderthals or Homo erectus, or some of the other relatives that we've discovered only more recently, like the Denisovans and Homo floresiensis, or the hobbit from islands Southeast Asia.
Well, now, you said just a second ago, Dr. Marks, that Homo means man. And so if you have Homo erectus, you would indicate that that would be a human. Homo naledi, which is this new discovery, was it human?
Well, if our criterion is, as I think it is generally now, was it bipedal or walking like an ape? Clearly, this is bipedal. Zach will certainly gladly tell you about its feet. He's just co-authored a paper on its feet. Mm-hmm. And I think if we look at its limb proportions, apes have long arms and short legs, humans have long legs and short arms, that seems to put it in our family, as opposed to a sort of bipedal small-brained, long-armed creature, which we call Australopithecus, which is fairly well-known in Africa.
Most people have probably heard of Lucy.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And Lucy is 3.2 million years old from East Africa.
But she wasn't human.
No.
Technically speaking.
Well, again, what Lucy has a small brain, but is in our lineage because of her bipedal walking gait. But she also had very long arms like a chimpanzee. Okay. So if you're looking for transitional forms, you know, the creationists often say, wow, there are no transitional forms. Boy, this is a beauty. Lucy was a beauty.
So this new discovery, Homo naledi, it has been said of this discovery that it may cause a paradigm shift in the way we think about human evolution. If you agree with that, Dr. Throckmorton, tell me why.
Well, I guess paradigm is kind of a loaded phrase. I mean, you know, you often hear it'll rewrite all the textbooks. Well, I don't think it's going to rewrite textbooks as much as cause a new and interesting chapter to be added onto them. Two of the more striking features of Homo naledi are certainly going to be causing a lot of discussion in the field moving forward, and whether they ultimately end up with large portions of textbooks being rewritten remains to be seen. The first is that Homo naledi has a mix of anatomy that is unusual. And I don't want to say unanticipated, because it's not terribly surprising for those of us who study the anatomy of hominin fossils. Specifically, it has a shoulder and upper limb, arm, and hand that are very clearly adapted to climbing behaviors. Now, whether they were climbing in trees, like we observe in chimpanzees, gorillas, orangutans, and gibbons today, or perhaps they were climbing around in caves or other forms of rocky outcroppings, we aren't entirely sure at this point. But along with this very climbing-adapted upper limb is a lower limb, and especially foot, that are clearly those of a striding, walking biped. Not exactly like you and me, but probably pretty similar based on how similar the foot and leg anatomy is. Yeah. Unfortunately, we don't have a ton of the pelvis or the hip, which is obviously pretty important in figuring out how these guys might have walked. But we have enough information from the rest of the leg to know that it was very human-like. So that kind of settles. We've had a long-standing debate in the field about when did humans come down from the trees? When did we sacrifice our ability to get around in the trees really well so that we could be better walkers? Well, here's something that's very human-like in many regards, and it apparently has not made the sacrifice. So this is a creature, these male and female Homo naledi apparently depended on the ability to climb and the ability to walk.
Since they have a feet in both camps, and I don't mean that as a pun, but since they are able to climb and they're obviously able to walk upright, could they be considered kind of a missing link in evolution from tree climbers to humans who walk on the earth?
Well, I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind is that humans are very good walkers, but it certainly doesn't preclude us from climbing today.
Right.
And our society, people generally don't do a ton of climbing unless they're in a specialized professional role that requires them to do that. But there are lots of people. I hear music. So
yep.
We'll
continue on the other side. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley Arant Bolt Cummings LLP, a full-service law firm whose lawyers are industry professionals experienced in serving the banking and financial services industry in Charlotte and throughout the nation. Details at babc.com. And Donald Hack Diamonds, serving Charlotte for over 30 years with fine diamonds, engagement rings, and jewelry for all occasions. Donald Hack Diamonds, Morrowcroft Shopping Village at Colony and Sharon Road, and at donaldhack.com. Days after Syrian-American composer and pianist Malik Jandali performed his protest song I Am My Homeland at a demonstration in front of the White House, security forces from the Assad regime attacked his parents in their home in Syria. John Dolley studied at Queen's University, became the first Arab-American composer to debut at Carnegie Hall, and he will join us to tell his story, talk about his music, and his homeland on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Democratic candidates for president meet in Las Vegas for the first debate of the 2016 race. How the candidates fared, what it means for the Democratic nomination for president.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a new discovery, anthropologically speaking, and I guess paleontologically speaking, and perhaps even genetically speaking, Homo naledi, which was found in South Africa near Johannesburg. We'll talk about where and why and how in just a moment with Dr. Zachary Throckmorton, an assistant professor of anatomy at Lincoln Memorial University's DeBusk College of Osteopathic Medicine. He's also one of the people working on this project, one of the scientists working on this. He's published the first analysis of Homo naledi, or one of the first analyses of it. Dr. Jonathan Marks, also with us from UNC Charlotte, where he's a professor of anthropology and author of Tales of the X-Apes. We think, what we think about human anatomy.
How
we think, exactly. That would be the right title. Okay, so the bones of Homo naledi were first uncovered in 2013, for those who are a little foggy on this, because I know we reported on this on NPR and on this station. And they were found in 2013 in a cave near Johannesburg, South Africa. I believe they were originally found, these bones, by spelunkers who then informed scientists. And the scientists were curious about it, so they sent them back in to look more carefully in this ancient cave. I wouldn't think that finding bones in an ancient cave would be that rare. So what made scientists interested enough to go back in, to send these people back in, and then come in themselves with their own team of scientists into this very difficult circumstance to uncover these fossils? What made it so interesting to them, Dr.
Two words, the anatomy.
Okay.
So one of the first specimens that was discovered in the chamber that's called the Dinaledi chamber, the chamber of stars, was a mandible that had teeth in it. And jaws and teeth are very diagnostic anatomically in mammals specifically, but in animals broadly, at least amongst animals that have teeth. And they took pictures of the mandible with the teeth and brought it to a paleoanthropologist who works at the University of the Witwatersrand, which is in Johannesburg, named Lee Berger. And Lee is a paleoanthropologist trained in anatomy, and he recognized right away that this was a jaw with teeth in it that is similar to what you would see in a modern human or a living human, but is different enough that it is not a human.
Mm-hmm.
And so he recognized right away that this might be something pretty spectacular.
This cave, and there's a diagram of this cave, and it's hard to do this in two dimensions, but it seems incredibly difficult to get to this cave. How deep is this cave?
Well, there's actually, for your listeners who are interested, there's a video uploaded to YouTube if they simply search Rising Star Cave that has a kind of a three-dimensional virtual fly-through that was constructed using lasers and other wonders of physics, courtesy of our geology team, so they can get a sense of how torturous it really is to get down into this chamber. It's pretty spectacular, the work that our excavation crew did with the assistance of the cavers. The work that they performed pulling these fossils out of this cave is truly impressive, and hats off to them for their important contribution.
Well, this cave, there are several areas of this cave that are less than 10 inches high. I mean,
right.
Seven and a half inches wide, and that means the lead scientist couldn't even. You have to be a very small person to get through.
Right.
The lead scientist couldn't get through. He sent proxies in for him, younger people, smaller people.
Qualified.
Yeah, qualified. But I mean, there's a place called Superman's Crawl, and it's called that because you have to tuck one arm next to your body and put the other arm out in front as though Superman were flying because you have to flatten yourself out. You can't get through. That brings up all kinds of questions. For instance, how did the animals get through? How did Homo naledi get through? How did they find the chamber?
Well, the answer to the question, how did the animals get through, is pretty straightforward, and that is they didn't. When we find sites like this that have a lot of human bones, we almost always find them with lots of animal bones as well, especially in South Africa and in East Africa for earlier, more primitive forms of human relatives. But in the Dinaledi chamber, there are some rodent incisors, which just goes to show that, you know, rats and mice get apparently everywhere on the planet. And there's an owl leg. And I always kind of thought, you know, that poor owl got stuck in that cave. But those are the only animal bones that are in there. Everything else is Homo naledi. And so, yeah, that raises the great question of how on earth did they get in there. And one of the things that to keep in mind is that Homo naledi is substantially smaller than we are, and we have so many specimens from both males and females that we know that Homo naledi males were a little bit bigger than the females, about the same percentage that humans are today, 20% or so. But the biggest Homo naledi males that we find in the cave are smaller than the smallest female cavers who actually went in there. So while it's very difficult for even a small human, male or female, who's narrow, to get into the cave today, it would have been substantially easier for Homo naledi to get into that than it is for us, simply because they're smaller than we are.
So here's what's intriguing to me, and you can tell me whether I should be intrigued by this, because I'm not a scientist. When you have a collection of bones such as you have in this chamber, there are literally thousands of them, and they indicate many, many, many intact bodies. That means that this creature intended for this cave to be a burial chamber. Correct?
Well, we're very careful in how we phrase our hypothesis on how they got in there in the paper, because the term burial is very culturally loaded, and it means something not just between species potentially, but burial can mean different things between different groups of people who are alive today. And so, you know, being very precise, careful scientists, we use the phrase deliberately disposed, because that's not really culturally loaded, and that appears to be what exactly happened. Our first set of papers, one about the anatomy of Homo naledi and the other about how they got into this cave, are freely available for anybody who has internet access and can read English on elifesciences.org. Or if you just go to Google and type in elife and Homo naledi, they'll pop up. And what we did is we systematically went through a number of different hypotheses that we figured, you know, might explain how these creatures got into this cave. And we borrowed from scenarios that we know have occurred at other fossil sites that have humans in them, and we systematically refuted all of them until we were left with the only viable explanation, given the available data at this point, that they were put in there by their conspecifics, that they were deliberately disposed of.
So is it unusual for non-human species of animals to have set aside a specific area for the disposal of dead bodies?
It is extremely unusual for mammals to do this. There are interesting examples in other animals. Ants and bees will do this also. Of course, you know, you wouldn't really call that a burial because you would never ascribe any sort of human intention to an ant. But they perform behaviors that are really not that dissimilar. But given the fact that, you know, the next closest relative to a human that does stuff like this is an insect, we're more confident in ascribing more human-like intentions to Homo naledi than we are more ant-like intentions to Homo naledi. But to this day, people will dispose of their dead relatives or friends or, you know, conspecifics of whatever sort, for some of the same reasons that insects will dispose of their dead. And one of those is that dead animals attract scavengers and predators. And one of the main reasons why humans bury their dead is because it prevents scavengers and predators from having easy access to them.
But we also do it for ritual and symbolic reasons.
Sure, yeah.
But that's why you don't want to use the word burial chamber, because you don't want to ascribe that to these creatures.
This is a creature that is like a human, but this is Homo naledi is not Homo sapiens. This is not us. And so.
But do we know that? I mean, do we know that they didn't do this as a ritual?
Oh, sorry.
We don't know that. I mean, as
no.
Zach was saying, we really don't know how the bones got into the chamber.
We know that there were multiple events, that they did not all go in there at one time, and that they were put in there over repeated events. Now, a ritual, at its very basic definition, is just a repeated behavior. So by that definition, repeatedly putting bodies into the cave is a ritual. Now, whether there was any sort of symbolism that went with it or any sort of ceremony or anything that you would associate with a modern, with a living person's burial, we do not have any evidence to indicate that at this point.
Hmm. How long have these bodies been, have these bones been in this chamber? Do we know?
We do not yet know.
Why not?
Because it's hard. it's real easy to, you know, we have, you mentioned, my specialty is foot and ankle anatomy, and it's really easy for me to read a foot when I have all of the bones there from multiple individuals. And so you can read about the foot and hand of Homo naledi more specifically on Nature Communications. Those are also open access. But dating these fossils is difficult. There's a long-standing, we get kind of spoiled by some of the fossil hominins that are discovered in East Africa that are near the Rift Valley and volcanic activity, which makes radiometric dating fairly straightforward in many cases. That doesn't happen in South Africa because of the geology, and attempts to date the cave are ongoing, and I hope that we will have an answer eventually. But again, succinctly, we don't have a date because it's really difficult.
But you said that actually not having a date has proven to be a positive because it helps researchers avoid preconceived notions that might bias their observations. Does that happen often in science?
I think that happens fairly frequently in my own field of studying human evolution and human paleontology or paleoanthropology, that you get the comments this could not possibly have this anatomy this recently, or this anatomy is so advanced and so human-like it couldn't possibly exist that far in the past. But I think probably the most illustrative example is what happened with Homo floresiensis, which has truly fascinating anatomy and is likely the result of a very well-understood evolutionary process called island or insular dwarfing. But what really stole the show was the fact that Homo floresiensis lived so recently. And I think that, you know, obviously knowing that Homo floresiensis lived recently is fascinating, but the anatomy and understand, you know, how this confirms that humans are subject to the same evolutionary pressures as many other types of animals, I think was really the big story there.
Some people in the field of paleontology, Dr. Marks, had previously been convinced that we'd found everything there was to find and that we had figured out our origins story, that the tree was complete, it was set in stone, we can move on to other things, we can sit by our computers and play. That's simplifying it, but if this finding proves that theory to be incorrect, so does it also mean that everything we thought was wrong?
Well, you used the phrase paradigm shift a little while ago. I don't think this is going to shift anyone's paradigm about the big picture of how we evolved, because the fossils of Homo naledi actually look a lot like fossils that we already knew about. I mean, obviously they have some distinctions, but they're very similar to stuff we already knew. I think what is really paradigm changing here is how the work was done, how quickly it was done. For example, 2 years from actually finding the site to having the stuff published. Less than 2 years. is ridiculously quick. We've had researchers sit on their fossils working on them for 15 years without getting the stuff published.
We have researchers who have sat on fossils for going on 16, 17 years, and there is no publication date in sight. right.
Well, two questions. Why that approach? Why this change in the approach?
Well, I think that the primary change in the approach is that there's been an increasing movement amongst all the natural sciences and the social sciences as well to really make an effort to show the general public that what we do matters and to have more people aware of what it is that we're doing and what the potential benefits to society at large are. And we've been looking, I think some of us in the field have been looking for a long time to push the open access frontier, you know, to publish our research in journals that are freely available for anyone to read, not just in the public, but at smaller institutions and universities that don't have gobs of money to be able to subscribe to expensive specialist journals. I think the other thing that necessitated this move was the fact that the sheer volume of fossils meant that if a small closed group of senior researchers were to work on this by themselves, it would have taken them 20, 30 years to even to come up with what we've done in less than 2 years. Mm. So one, there are a lot of people looking to change the way science in general is done, and that includes people in the field of paleoanthropology, and two, this was the best way to do it given the situation and how much there was to get done.
So far, scientists have found more than 1,550 fossil elements. Almost every bone in the body represented multiple times. The find is described as the largest find of its kind anywhere in the world, and scientists believe they've only uncovered a fraction of what is in that cave. What does this mean?
Well, real quick, a point of clarification. It's the largest find of its kind in Africa.
Okay.
There is a similar but somewhat different scenario that happened in a site called Cima de los Huesos, or the Pit of Bones in Spain. And they have more hominin fossils than we do at this point, but they also have a lot of other types of animals in there, too. Regardless, they're both pretty spectacular sites.
And also the stuff in Spain is probably a bit later because the hominids that are there are much more like us than Homo
Naledius.
Right.
So since there's such a large amount of fossils of one species and one species alone in this chamber, could there be other chambers scattered throughout the area like this, or would this be the only one? Could this be the only one?
I will simply say that we have published on the over 1,500 specimens at this point, and to stay tuned.
But there are also other cave sites throughout that area in South Africa. We've been finding fossils in the Johannesburg area since, 1925?
For almost 100 years, yeah.
Hmm. When we come back, we're going to talk about specifically what makes this newly discovered species distinct or different from those that we already have known about for years and years, and what makes it significant and what makes it kind of not exactly a missing link, but kind of like a missing link between apes and humans. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar, located at Brookdale Village in Lake Norman, offering wines from around the world, live local music, and craft beer on tap. Relax, uncork, unwind. The Corkscrew. Details at thecorkscrew.com. Democratic candidates for president met in Las Vegas for the first debate of the 2016 race last night. And coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, Diane Rehm and a panel of political insiders look at how the candidates fared and what it means for the Democratic nomination for president. That's all upcoming on this program, on this radio station on WFAE. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. You can reach us through Facebook or Twitter at WFAE, or you can email us, charlottetalks@wfae.org, and we're coming right back.
We say it as often as possible, but we can never say it enough. Thank you. Thank you to everyone who supports WFAE and to the nearly 3,000 people who donated to us as part of our recent on-air fundraising campaign. This is Jeff Bundy from WFAE's membership team. We are still working towards our overall goal for the fall campaign. If you've not yet made a donation to WFAE, please join your friends and neighbor by making a gift right now at WFAE.org or at 704-549-9000. And thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Today we're talking about Homo Naledi, a find in South Africa near Johannesburg in a chamber which served kind of as a body disposal area for a new species that the scientists, actually spelunkers, discovered, and scientists have now uncovered and are uncovering new facts about them as we speak. Dr. Zachary Throckmorton was one of those scientists tasked with identifying certain aspects of their anatomy, which we're going to talk about in a second because they're human-like in some ways. He is an assistant professor of anatomy at Lincoln Memorial University's DeBusk College of Osteopathic Medicine in Harrogate, Tennessee. He joins us by phone from there this morning. And Dr. Jonathan Marks from UNC Charlotte, the author of Tales of the X-Apes, How We Think About Human Evolution and What It Means to Be 98% Chimpanzee, also with us. So these creatures, these fossils were discovered. What makes them different from what we've already known? Is it the fact that their teeth are human-like, more human-like than chimpanzees? The fact that they have hands and feet that are more human-like than ape-like?
Yeah, every bit of the anatomy of Homo naledi is more human-like than chimp-like, with one glaring exception, and that's its brain size. Its brain size is much closer to a chimpanzee than to our own. It has pretty small brains, but just about everything else is much more like us. I have alluded earlier to the upper limb being more adapted to climbing. The details of the shoulder joint are more like a chimp than a human. But when we find fossils like this, sometimes we make an assertion of a new species based only or primarily upon tooth anatomy. Teeth are very useful in discriminating one group of animals from another because they adapt very quickly to the diet of the animal and for other reasons. But fortunately, with Homo naledi, we were able to use a lot more than just the teeth in order to make a new species diagnosis. We have, like has been alluded, we have a lot of fossils. And those fossils represent males and females of all ages, and we have at least 15 of them that have been excavated so far. And so the brain is, like I said, small. The shoulder is kind of apish, but most of the rest of the details of the anatomy are very human.
But these creatures were smaller than we were. How much smaller?
I would say that the big males were probably just under 5 feet tall, and the females were probably just over 4 feet tall.
So if you have a smaller anatomy overall, does it matter that your brain is smaller?
Yeah.
Okay.
The bottom line is that, their brains are a third the size of ours.
Okay.
So if you take the average human today, thinking globally, not just in the United States, with a man of about 5'6", and you make a third the size, you're talking about a human that's less than 2 feet tall.
Okay, so what does the presence of human-like features in the hands and feet mean? Because you wrote the paper on this. You wrote the paper on the anatomy of the foot and ankle.
Well,
I was
one of them. And I did not. I'm not actually a co-author on the hand paper, but I can speak about it.
Okay.
The interesting aspects of the foot are that it is so modern. Like when I first started seeing pictures of it via email before I got to South Africa, my initial concern was this some sort of child laborer who was down there mining? The heel bone, the calcaneus, is a little too narrow in a. But other than that, it's a very, very human-looking foot. I saw other pictures of the rest of the specimens. There's clearly not a child laborer mm-hmm. that was down there mining. But the hand is interesting in that its fingers are curved, and actually so are the toe bones. Couldn't see it on the pictures initially, but you can now. And the curvature of the fingers is a adaptation to being arboreal, which is actually more like a chimp than it is like us. But the details of the wrist and the thumb The thumb is heavily muscularized, and it has short fingers and a long thumb like we do, as opposed to chimps that have long fingers and a short thumb. Those are pretty clearly reflections that Homo naledi has the hand of a tool maker. Of course, the problem is chimpanzees make tools and use them too, and their hands are different than ours, but the finger-thumb proportions and the musculature of a thumb are much more like a human than they are like a chimp.
How can you tell about the musculature when there's no tissue remaining, soft tissue?
Sure, yeah. Muscles leave marks on bones, and depending on where those muscles actually attach to the bones determines where the marks on the bones are, and then the specific marks on the bones will vary based on how strong the muscle actually is. Homo naledi is very interesting in that there's a detail of its tibia where its some of its hip muscles attach down on its leg that is unlike anything else that we've ever found. It's not like us. It's not like chimps. It's not like any other sort of human relative. And we're working on trying to figure out what caused that. But we know what attaches there, which muscles attach there in humans. And we can then surmise, you know, well, these muscles that were in Homo naledi were probably much more active in naledi than they are in humans because it's got this big bump on this bone that humans don't have.
So its legs are basically those of a human. If you're asking the question, are its legs like a chimp or like a human? Its legs are more like a human.
Yes, absolutely.
And its feet are weight bearing structures rather than grasping structures.
Yep. Yeah, the big toe is completely in line with the rest of the foot. It was not grasping at things with its big toe. The most grasping it could probably do with its toes is just like you and me. That might be able to pick up an errant Kleenex off of the floor without having to bend over. Hmm. But they're definitely not using their feet in the way that chimpanzees do to climb.
And their teeth are also much more like human teeth. They aren't human teeth, but they're much more like human teeth.
In what way, and what does that tell you?
Yeah, well, the anterior teeth are smaller. The molars are smaller. The canines are small, and chimpanzees, gorillas, and all the other, basically almost all the other primates, males have very large canines, and females have small canines.
So is that and they use those canines to tear flesh? Is that no?
No, to threaten mostly.
To threaten.
It's more so.
So what does it mean that the teeth are more human? Does it tell you what they ate or how they ate or who? Okay.
Yeah, it tells us not only about what they ate, probably pretty omnivorous, just like humans are today, but we don't have a lot of really good direct evidence about that yet. But the diminution or the shrinking of the canines in the males tells us something about how they might have organized themselves into groups and what their mating systems might have been like. I don't know if John would like to take it from there. He knows a lot about that.
Well, I mean, we don't know exactly why our canine teeth are smaller than chimpanzee canine teeth. One suggestion is that since they're sexually dimorphic in the apes, that is to say males have much bigger canine teeth than females have, that it has something to do with competing for mates, males competing more by making these aggressive threat displays than females. There's another thing that teeth do, of course, and that's teeth are involved in communication in humans to a much greater extent than they are in chimpanzees. Speaking is something that's really hard to do through large interlocking canine teeth. And if you're a fan of vampire films, you reckon you got to take those fangs out before you can talk. So it's also very possible that species with small canine teeth are getting proto-language.
Well, I was going to ask about that, because if they have small brains but mouths that are suited for speaking, could they have developed any kind of language at all?
Well, again, we don't know the learning curve. One of the interesting things about the evolution of language is that we don't have any half languages. All languages are equally useful in communicating everything that all humans that speak them need to do. So we don't know really what a half-formed language would be like. But we know, obviously, we communicate quite differently from the way chimpanzees communicate.
And one of the real unfortunate parts of the discovery of Homo naledi, of all of the bones that we have, we do not have any hyoid bones, which is the bone that is in your throat that many of the muscles that you use to control your tongue when you speak attach to. And so we try to infer whether or not a ancient human relative might be able to speak by the anatomy of this hyoid bone, and we don't have one from naledi yet.
And we also don't have tools, and that's kind of interesting,
right?
Because it looks like their hands are the hand, the reason chimpanzees don't make fine stone tools
is that they don't have the dexterity.
Well, they don't have the brains and they don't have the dexterity.
Can you tell by the way the bones are laid out in the cave as you uncover them or as you find them? Because some of them, I think, were on the surface. Can you tell how carefully they were placed there? Were they just dropped there and left, or were they laid out in some way?
Well, we took the I shouldn't say we. I'm way too big to get into the cave. Our caving crew went to great pains to very meticulously document the arrangement of the bones, because as your question is great, yeah, you can sometimes use the arrangement of bones to figure out how they got in there. And so they 3D laser scanned the entire floor. I think that they took something like 30,000 photos. It was just a very, very impressive, detailed documentation of where the bones came from. And unfortunately, after reviewing the evidence, it seems that we are unable to really tell whether they were maybe more gently placed in there, or if they were just straight up dumped down that chute.
But it is also, from my perspective as someone who wasn't involved in this particular excavation, this is probably the weakest part of the whole story of Homo naledi, the idea that, well, they stood over the cave and sort of put Og, their dead father, into the hole there. But, of course, what it does is, if that's true, it makes them sound much more human in their behavior,
sure,
which, again, we don't have access to. But that's a way of seeing them as even more like us than just their anatomy would dictate.
Yeah, and the important thing to keep in mind is that humans are much more than their genetics or their anatomy, and we're cultural beings. So when you asked the question at the beginning, who are we and where did we come from? Well, my name is Zach, and I'm originally from Lansing, Michigan, and that has very little to do with my genetics or my anatomy, and it has a lot more to do with my culture.
So we just found this species. We didn't know it existed, and I'm curious as to why that could be, how that could be, I guess. Could it be that they were just a small unit species in a very small geographic area that somehow was wiped out, and the only evidence we have is this chamber where they put their dead? Could they be all over Africa and we just haven't found them yet? And if so, how is that possible?
Well, again, they're not completely unlike everything that we've ever known about. So I think there is a question there about whether we have discovered a new branch of our family tree, or whether one of the older branches has just gotten larger or wider, or even whether the tree metaphor is not one that we should be playing with anymore because it's run its course. Mm-hmm. And other people are talking about whether we should talk about braided rivers or more capillary systems, streams running together and things like that.
So you're saying that maybe the design of the tree, that the tree thing is not the way we should do this.
It's a very powerful metaphor, and it's gotten us very far. And
it's simple.
It's
easy to explain, and it's easy to understand. And generally speaking, things that are easy to explain and easy to understand are not always very accurate.
Okay.
But remember also,
one of the most intriguing parts about this, like you said, is that we have found something that is new and is very interesting. This site is less than 1 kilometer, less than a mile away from another site near Johannesburg that has been producing fossils of hominins and other animals for decades, that is worked on every single day. Maybe not on Sundays, but almost every single day. And I think it really highlights how little we know and how little we've explored and how much there really is still out there for us to discover.
Would you say that this discovery is an indication of evolution, or simply another species, distinct and unto itself?
Well, if you mean, did this? If you're asking, how did this creature come to exist and how did it go extinct? I mean, obviously, it came from somewhere. It's descended from something, and whether it was a dead end and didn't evolve into anything else, or whether we are descended from it or from a close relative of it, is sort of beyond the point. And it's beyond the point for an important reason. In the fossil record, we don't find ancestor-descendant relationships. We make
right.
ancestor-descendant relationships.
What does that mean?
You find fossils, and you draw the line that connects them.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So whenever we see just the statement, fossil A evolved into fossil B, that's a story. And it's a story that might be true. But it could also be the case that A didn't evolve into B, a very close relative of A, let's call it A prime, that we haven't found yet, is
yep.
what actually evolved into B. So we're always the ones, we don't find fossils and we don't find species. We make the species from the fossils and we link up the species into ancestral descendant relationships.
So could we be wrong?
We are always wrong. We just try and get more right.
Well, you say, Dr. Throckmorton, that what we've done here and what we've found here is just the tip of the iceberg. So I guess, and you said just a moment ago, stay tuned for more.
And it will be open access. Anybody will be able to read it.
Okay. Well, we'll stay tuned for more. How soon, by the way? Is there a fall season coming or a mid-season replacement? Dr. Zachary Throckmorton, Assistant Professor of Anatomy at Lincoln Memorial University's DeBusk College of Osteopathic Medicine in Tennessee, and Dr. Jonathan Marks from UNC Charlotte, where he's a Professor of Anthropology. Thank you both for the hour.